No, there's dozens of other panels you can be in. I really appreciate that you guys chose this one to learn about how we can apply some psychology to improve our e-commerce conversion rates. My name is Joe. I'm from Austin. Who else is from Austin? Awesome. Okay. His name is Austin, by the way. So if you guys want to follow along on Twitter or share what you're learning, the hashtag is BrainConf, Brain C-O-N-V. And by way of introduction, I've been working in e-commerce since 1998 in one form or another. And I've always found that when I can understand why something is happening, why something is working, if I can extract that principle, I can then easily apply that to another project, another experience, another site. And so that's the goal today, is to extract some of these principles that you guys can take home and apply on your projects. So right now I'm a senior e-commerce product manager. I work at National Instruments here in Austin. We are a global company. We help software. We sell software and computer hardware to scientists and engineers around the world to help them to be more productive, more innovative, and solving some of the world's biggest challenges. We are a B2B company, and yet we found great success in applying B2C principles in our efforts. So a lot of the examples I share today will be from stuff that we've done in our company and also from across the web. Now, one place you will not find our products is at the grocery store. So that's where we're going to start today. So I want you guys to imagine that you're in your favorite grocery store, and you are pushing your cart down the aisle, and you turn the corner, and there before you is the free sample table. Who loves the free sample table? Yeah, of course you do. So on this free sample table, there is gourmet jam, jars of jam. Now this, in actuality, is a classic research experiment by the folks at Stanford and Columbia to try to determine how the complexity of the choices that we give to customers impacts their purchasing behavior and their purchasing decisions. So they have a table, and on this table they have 24 jars of jam. And they track how many people come to the table. They give them a coupon, they go on, and they see how many people actually purchase the jam. And then they repeat the experiment with the table with only 6 jars of jam. They track how many people come to the table, they give them a coupon, they see how many people go on to purchase. So that begs the question, which table attracted more people? How many of y'all think the table with 24 jars of jam attracted more people? How many think the table with 6 jars of jam attracted more people? Okay? As far as attracting people to the table, 24 jars of jam attracted more people. Hey, look at all the jam! I can't help but go over and look at it. So that begs the question, if it attracted more people, which led to more sales? Which had the higher conversion rate? Table with 24 jars of jam or the table with 6? How many think 24? 6. So everybody else raises their hand, right? 6 it is. In fact, those that visited the table with 6 jars of jam were 10 times more likely to purchase. So even though they had equal incentive, there's a coupon, you should still buy it. Those that visited the table with 24 jars of jam, simply overwhelmed by choices. Now we've seen that here at South By. Who got one of these things? Right? This is just like jam, right? Which panel should I go to? There's so many of them. It's a little bit overwhelming. So I work in National Instruments. We sell products that look kind of like this. We do not sell jam. Pretty sure you guys don't sell jam. Anybody sell jam here? No? Okay. Nevertheless, the principles of this experiment are applicable to all of us as e-commerce merchants. We are all on this road. Our customers are down here at the bottom. We want to get them up the road to the point of sale, to the point of conversion. And between the sale and the customer are the choices that we give to our customers on our sites. Now, these choices could be roadblocks, like these rhinos, or they can be empowering, compelling choices that propel them to the point of conversion and the point of sale. Now, when customers arrive at your site, sometimes they look like this. And when customers look like this, they are not going to buy from you. Now, when they arrive on your doorstep on your site, they bring some mental baggage with them, some history. And sometimes that affects their purchasing behavior. For example, they may assume that the choices that you are going to present to them are going to be quick and easy choices. Well, why? Because maybe those on your competitor's site were quick and easy, or all the choices they made this morning offline were quick and easy. But when they come to your site, maybe those choices are not a quick or easy thing to make. So, likewise, your customers are looking for the perfect choice. Who's seen bluebonnets already here in Texas? Good. It is springtime. So, customers are looking for that perfect selection, the perfect choice when they come to your site. Why? Well, they're constantly bombarded by marketing messages telling them, hey, there's a perfect everything for you. There's a perfect house, perfect car, perfect family vacation. So when they come to your site, they're looking for that perfect match to their needs. And sometimes it's hard to find that perfect choice. Now, when you take all those considerations and you mix them together with the other things that are going on in their head. Maybe they've got some stress at work. They've got their boss's expectations. Maybe they have a history with you and your company, and they start to look kind of like this guy. Or a little overloaded mentally as far as what they should do on your site and how they should make a choice. They're suffering from the classic analysis paralysis. They're trying to weigh in their minds the pros and the cons of purchasing your product from you on your site today. And too often the case is that the cons outweigh the pros, the risks are too great, or there's too many unknowns, and they simply walk away. Now, if you're lucky, you're a multi-channel company, and they can walk away from you, and they can just pick up the phone and call your toll-free number. Maybe they don't purchase online. But too often the case is that they walk away, and they don't come back. They walk away to a competitor site. The customers that do stick around may simply resort to picking you or your product. Now, picking is such a fleeting, passive type of selection. I'm going to pick this one, right? They could pick you just as easily as they could pick the guy next to you. There's not much of a commitment there, especially when you contrast that with a choice. When customers choose you, there's more of a longer-term commitment, a longer-term relationship and investment in the future. Now, you need to be chosen, right? As e-commerce merchants, your entire business model may be hinging on the fact that these customers are going to be customers for a long time. They're going to come back and they're going to buy from you again. If you're in the B2B space, maybe they're going to buy one thing right now, they're going to try it out, and they're going to then come back and buy 1,000 of these products and deploy them across their entire enterprise. That's a choice. It's not a pick. And you want your customers to choose you and your product on your site today. Now, if we want customers to choose us, we need to help them understand the choices that we present to them, and we need to help them understand the trade-offs that those preferences are requiring. Fortunately, there's some very smart minds in academia to help us understand how we present these trade-offs and these choices to customers. Professor Soman at the University of Toronto and Professor Gorville at Harvard help explain some of these trade-offs that we give to customers. They describe them as alignable versus non-alignable trade-offs and choices. Now, let's look at alignable first. So alignable trade-offs are choices along a single dimension where there's just one thing that's different perhaps across these products. For example, are you thirsty? Well, do you want a small, a medium, or a large drink? It's just one thing that differentiates between the products, and it's easy to make that choice. Now, you very well may sell products that are alignable in nature. Some of the products that we sell are, like, do you want the widget on the left, or do you want the widget on the right? Now, under the hood, the technical specs are very, very similar. There's just one difference. One is a little bit faster than the other. That becomes the alignable trade-off. Do you want a little more speed? Okay, go with the widget on the left. Now, if you contrast that with a non-alignable trade-off, things start to get kind of complicated. It's almost lunchtime. What do you guys want for lunch? Do you want Tex-Mex or do you want barbecue? Because if you go to the barbecue place, you're not going to get Tex-Mex. A non-alignable trade-off is an all-or-nothing proposition. And so once you commit to that choice, there's kind of no going back. And so when we present these types of choices to our customers, they start to have anxiety about making that choice. Well, what if I really want a Tex-Mex and I'm sitting in the barbecue place? They start to have reservations about making the choice and making the purchase, and that's not the mindset you want the customer to be in on your website. So we've talked a little bit about the choices that we're presenting, how they're affecting your customer's decision-making ability and their behavior. And so now it's time for us to do something about that and how we can adjust our efforts as e-commerce merchants to adapt to some of these complexities of the choices that we have to present to them. Now, we talked about how your customers kind of look like this on your site. Now, when someone looks like this, they're not going to pull out their wallet and they're not going to buy from you. We want to move them from this state to happy state, right? Now, of course, the earlier we get them hooked on our products, the better, too. And so happy customers are going to purchase. So we're going to talk about 15 different principles and tools today that you can apply on your e-commerce site and selling your products and your services. Now, as I talk about each of these principles and each of these examples, you guys are going to have some homework. Now, here in Texas, it's spring break right now. All the students are out of school. But you guys still have homework today. Because if you don't apply the principles we talk about, this session is kind of a waste. And so I'm going to ask you guys a series of introspective questions that you need to think about how they apply to you and how they apply to your products and your services and how you're selling those on your sites. Okay, the first tool in our toolkit is that of simplifying the choices that we give to customers. Now, here's an example. Who has used Woot? Okay, fair number of people. So Woot is a deal-a-day site, and the choice is very simple. Do you want this offer? I want one. Yes or no? Now here, contrast that with an example from something we used to have on our site. Looks kind of like this. And when it came time to choose an accessory, you'd have to scroll through this long, nasty list of products. So we applied this principle of simplifying and streamlining the experience. Make it look a little bit something like this. We show customers how the pieces fit together. We show you the parts that you're going to need. And we let you change them if you need to. And so by streamlining and simplifying the experience, we're able to reduce some of that complexity of the choices that we were presenting. And we saw a pretty nice boost. We saw about a 30% pop in units and revenue through our e-commerce channel for that product line, which is significant by applying such a simple principle of simplification and streamlining the experience. So that brings us to your first homework assignment. How can you simplify the choices that you are giving to your customers such that it's easier to digest visually what you're presenting to them so that they can make that choice and make the selection? Okay, then the second tool in our toolkit is to help customers understand their preferences and the trade-offs that those preferences require. We at National Instruments, we sell software. Our flagship software is called LabVIEW. But we have different flavors of LabVIEW, and sometimes it's hard to decide which version is the right version for you. So we built this little tool called Help Me Choose Software, where the customer can choose on the left, I want my software to do X, Y, and Z. And when they make those choices on the right, we immediately start to change out the recommendation in the software that is going to meet their needs. And so they start to see right away the cause and effect of that preference. Well, if I really need the software to do this, this is what I'm going to have to buy, this is how much it's going to cost, here's the other functionality I can get. And so customers start to see the consequence of that action right up front in this pre-sales mode to help them make a good choice. Now, with this experience, we saw about a 50% better conversion rate to our shopping cart and our quote applications than we did through our traditional product page, where the customer would have to decide for themselves without this Help Me Choose experience. So that brings us to a great example on the web, HipMunk. Who used HipMunk to help get here to South by Southwest? Yeah? So these guys present visually the trade-offs of different flights. So at a glance, you can see if I go with this different airline, what it means for when I have to leave, when I'm going to get there, how long I'm going to be stuck in the airport on a layover, even how many different layovers I have. So it's a very clear cause and effect. I can see the trade-offs based on my preferences of airline or departure time or departure airport. So that brings us to your next homework assignment. How can you help customers understand their preferences and the trade-offs? How can you help them see that cause and effect? Because when customers can see the consequence of that action, it's not so scary to make that choice. It's not an unknown. They can see the ramifications of that choice. Okay, that brings us to number three, organizing and eliminating options that we give to customers. Here's an example from Dell where they group customers into different buckets. Lots of sites do this. For example, the enterprise customer is not going to be distracted then by the latest home entertainment system. And the home user isn't going to be distracted by the latest rack-mounted servers. Now, we use this principle in one of our product lines called data loggers. We ask a very simple question to customers. What do you want to measure? Well, in this case, I want to measure temperature. Okay, so immediately, knowing that, we eliminate everything that has nothing to do with temperature, only show you the most relevant products. And so we applied this principle to remove these distractions. Sometimes we show the customer too many things that have nothing to do with what they're looking at or what they want to look at or what they need at the time. And so by eliminating these distractions, it helps people find and choose the product. And so doing, we found about double the amount of people actually reaching and finding the products that they were looking for in this product family. So your homework assignment, how can you organize and eliminate options based on what you know about the customer? So it may be based on the last click. You may know how they navigated to this point of the site, and so you know what they're really interested in. It may be based on their past purchase history or their browsing history that you can leverage to present only the most relevant products and information. All right, let's talk about number four, attribute-based decisions. Has anybody eaten at Freebirds? Okay, so if you're in Austin, you should probably have a burrito. There's lots of great burrito places here in town. Now, when you go into Freebirds, they ask you a series of questions. Do you want a flour tortilla or do you want a spinach tortilla? Do you want steak? Do you want chicken? Do you want refried beans or do you want black beans? And so by asking this series of easy-to-answer questions, ultimately it builds up to the perfect burrito. Now, we at National Instruments, we sell burritos too. Our burritos just look like this. They're a little crunchy. Your dentist may not approve. But the complexity of the products we sell required that we did something a little different. And so we leveraged this principle of attribute-based decisions to ask a series of questions of our customer. We built these tools called advisors, which walk the customer through step by step to configure this more complicated system. So for example, here, what do you want to measure? Well, I want to measure voltage. Okay, well, do you want voltage input or do you want voltage output? Okay, great. Well, do you want this range of voltage or do you want that range of voltage? And so doing, by asking a series of these easy to answer questions, it ultimately builds up to a more complex system and a complex decision for the customer. So your homework is to consider how can you simplify the choices that you give to customers to a single attribute or a single care about at a time. That way it's easy for them to answer that one question and move on to the next step. And you can guide them to the product or service that's best for them. Tool number five is that of recommendations. Now, when we take this all the time in the real world, like say you're at a hotel and you ask the concierge, well, where should I go for dinner tonight? And you go to that restaurant and you take the server's recommendation of what should I have for dinner? Now, we take a website's recommendation when we accept the defaults that the website presents to us. Now, who here has used Kiva, kiva.org? Kiva is a great service where you can give microloans to the working poor around the world. For example, in this case, Blanca, she lives in El Salvador, and she has a little general store. You can loan her some money. She sells the products to her customers, repays the loan, and you can turn around and loan the money to another entrepreneur. Now, Kiva really wants you to finish your task, which is funding the loan for Blanca and others like her. And so they want to eliminate anything that may prevent you from doing that. So one of the questions is, well, how much money should I even loan to Blanca? Well, they default $25. Okay, sounds good. Now, Kiva is a nonprofit. They also want you to keep the lights on, so they default a recommendation of how much you should donate for their operating costs. And in so doing, they eliminate some of these micro decisions, which may be stumbling blocks for people on their way to completing the task at hand, which is funding the loan to Blanca. So your homework is to consider how can you leverage defaults or recommendations in presenting products and selections to customers. Now be very careful with defaults because people will take the default. And so consider the downstream consequence of that choice. Are you going to have to make more of that widget? Are you going to have an inventory problem? Are you going to have to support that particular product or service more? Maybe a certain product has higher needs than others. So consider the downstream consequences for your commerce, for your company, as well as for the customer with defaults and recommendations. Okay, tool number six is that of social proof. Now, if you've ever seen social proof in action, you've probably seen it here at South By. There's a line of people. I need to be in that line. I don't know what they're waiting for, but I'm going to jump in the back of it. Something good is going to happen, right? It's going to be a free drink, free food, free giveaway, free something, right? It is our human nature to follow the crowd of people that we see. For example, when we see people running in a certain direction, these people are usually running for a reason. Now, social proof becomes extremely powerful when it is localized and personalized to you, the individual. So think about how different people influence your purchasing behavior and how within your different circles of influence that affects your purchasing behavior. For example, if you go over to Amazon and you're looking at anonymous reviews of products, an anonymous review may have a certain weight on your decision to purchase. Now, if you contrast that with a recommendation at work, you may get from your boss, says, hey, I recommend you buy this thing, or a recommendation you may get from your mom, right? Each of these has a different weight in your purchasing decision. Now, imagine that you are an engineer. You work for Acme Incorporated. This is a company that used to make those gadgets when the Roadrunner would chase the Wile E. Coyote would chase the Roadrunner. So you work at Acme, and you come to our website, and you start to see references to your company. You say, Acme. Hey, I work at Acme. I'm intrigued. I click on the tab, and I see this guy named Brian. I know that guy. I know Brian. He works at my company. Let me see what he's saying here. Oh, look. He's saying this is an awesome product, that we should buy it. We should standardize on our company. So instantly, you've gained credibility in the eyes of the prospective customer because somebody they trust already trusts you. And when that trust and the credibility is established, it's easier for your prospective customer to make that choice because they can rely on the trust that they're borrowing essentially from somebody they already know. Now, localized and targeted social proof also works in a geographic sense. So if customers assume you're this huge, maybe a global company, and you start to see references to where they live. Hey, I live in Texas. Look at this. Well, maybe they're in my backyard. Maybe I should try them out, give them a call, and see what can happen. So your homework is to consider, how can you sprinkle some of the social proof into your e-commerce? How can you go beyond the high-level generic testimonial to very targeted and relevant social proof to the customer, something that resonates with them? Maybe it's somebody at their company. Maybe it's somebody in their industry. Maybe it's somebody in their neighborhood. They can say, oh, yeah, that person's just like me. And they like this product. I know I'm going to like it, too. Okay, the next tool is ownership bias. Now, who here has either had a garage sale, yard sale, or gone to a garage sale? Okay, so you think, all right, I've got this brilliant idea. I'm going to clean out my closet, my attic, my garage, put it all in the driveway, all my junk. People are going to buy it. I'm going to be rich, right? And so you put all your stuff out there, and people start to come looking at your stuff. And then all of a sudden, someone's looking at this desk that you have for sale. Now, this is one of those desks. You put it together like 5 years ago. You bought it from the store that has instructions with no words, it's just pictures, and you spent an entire weekend putting this desk together. It was a grand challenge, and you mastered the desk. But you don't use it anymore, right? Because you're always on your laptop at the coffee shop. And so you think, I'm going to sell the desk, and I'm going to be rich. So somebody comes to you and says, hey, I like this desk. Can I buy it? And you're like, sure. How much will you give me for it? And they say, I'll give you $5 for the desk. And you're like, what? $5? Are you kidding me? This desk is like a work of art. I can spend an entire weekend of my life, blood, sweat, and tears on this desk. That is the ownership bias. Because you invested so much time, effort, and energy in that desk, you have a higher value in your mind of that product than someone off the street who wants to just give you $5 for it. Now, we as e-commerce merchants, we can leverage the same principle of ownership bias to compel people to purchase from us. Here's an example from Snapfish. There's lots of sites like this where you can customers can upload customized products, make them personal. And in so doing, they start to get the ownership bias. Customers feel like, this is my product. I haven't bought it yet. I haven't even added it to the shopping cart, right? But it's already mine because I've made it mine through the time that I've invested in creating it, personalizing it, and configuring it. So your homework is, how can you help customers feel that ownership bias of your product? How can you help them spend more time with your product on your website, help them feel like it's theirs, they know it, they can customize it, personalize it, so that naturally they're going to take the next step. Naturally they're going to add to cart and purchase because it's already theirs. Okay, let's talk about pricing anchors, which is number 8. So you fly into town and you're leaving the airport, and the first thing you see is that gas station on the corner, and you see the price of gas, and you think, oh, that's how much gas costs here. Okay, well, it's a little different to back home. Maybe it's a little more, maybe a little less. And so this sets the baseline. It sets the anchor for pricing for your entire trip to this new city. Every other gas station you see, it's going to be measured against that original price that you saw. So we as e-commerce merchants can leverage the same pricing anchor as we present pricing and the value that we offer to our customers. A classic example, of course, is to show the list price of products. Do a big slash through that price. Say, not here, folks. Big discount, 42%. This is great if you sell a product that is sold in other places, and maybe you are competing on price. It's easy for customers to see, I should definitely buy here because it's a better deal. Now, sometimes we sell products where the customer may not know what the price of the product should even be. Here's an example from ClickTail, a great analytics program for your websites. Now, they have different service offerings for monthly plans. Now, if you're reading left to right, the first price you see is this $990 a month. But as you work left to right, you get down to this $99 a month, and you think, well, yeah, $99, that's not too bad, especially compared to $1,000 a month. Surely, I can try that plan out, right? So what they've done is they've anchored the price of what a great value is against their own product offering to help convince you that you shouldn't just walk away because it's too much. No, $99 is a fair price. I'm going to try at least that plan, if not one of the other offerings. So how can you anchor price in your favor on your site? How can you help your customers understand that, yes, you offer a good value for the price? Maybe it's against the competition through some kind of discount, showing the discount price that you offer, or perhaps it's anchoring the price in their mind against one of your other offerings so that even though they might not buy your most expensive offering, that compels them to purchase one of your other offerings in your portfolio. All right, let's talk about scarcity. If you've ever lived in a house with more than one person, and there's a plate of cookies in the kitchen on the counter, and you pass through the kitchen and there's just one cookie left, you think, I'm going to pick up that cookie. I'm going to eat the cookie. Because I know if I leave the kitchen and I come back later, that cookie's going to be gone, right? Because there's just one left. That is a principle of scarcity. Now, we as e-commerce merchants can leverage this same principle to help customers to grab that cookie right now, to take action right now to purchase from us. Time is one of the things that could be scarce. Who's used AppSumo? Yeah, a couple? So it's like a deal a day site for geeks, for us. They want you to purchase. They want you to purchase right now. So they use this principle of time scarcity. For example, here it says available for 6 days. Other times it's a countdown with a little clock showing you how much time you have left. Other times it's ambiguous. It says for a limited time only. And so when you see that messaging, you start to think, well, I'm kind of interested in this product, but you know, I probably shouldn't wait because if I wait, it's going to be gone. Someone's going to eat that cookie and I'm not going to get a chance. So communicating that there's a time scarcity will compel people to take action right now. Likewise, you can communicate quantity scarcity. Here's an example from Etsy. Who's sold something on Etsy? Anybody? No? But good. So by its nature, there's often a limited amount of products that you sell. These are some awesome crayons. They're shaped like little Lego guys. And you think, that's pretty slick. You know, I should probably get those. And you look over there and there's only one available. You're like, okay, I'm going to buy it right now because otherwise someone's going to come along, steal those crayons. They're my crayons. I'm going to buy them right now. So by communicating the quantity that you have left or the inventory, you're able to compel people to take action and purchase from you because they don't want to miss out. They don't want to wait for you to restock and send it to them later. So your homework is, how can you communicate scarcity to your customers on your site? Now notice I did not say, how can you manufacture fake scarcity? Because customers are going to start to see through that and you undermine the trust that you have with your customers. But if you have real scarcity of time, maybe a limited time offer, limited inventory, by all means communicate that and elevate that to the customer so that they want to take action right now. They'll purchase from you today. Okay, contrasting your call to action. Who's seen a sign like this before? You're driving down the street, pedestrian sign. Now these signs, they used to be a different color. They used to be more orangish yellow like the stripes on the road. Now they are this bright green, iridescent, alien type of color. So regardless of what's behind the sign, on the side of the sign, in your periphery, you will see this sign, right? Why? Because we don't want you to run over our kids. Right? It is a compelling call to action. Now, we as e-commerce merchants can likewise leverage this principle in our efforts to get people's attention to the action that we want them to take. Here's an example from Zappos. So even if you're not in Texas, you can still buy boots. Now, notice the colors here. Orange pops out, are their primary calls to action. They want you to search. They want you to have something to do with shopping cart. It is the most obvious color on the page, because of the contrast between that call to action and the rest of the page. You cannot help but see it and notice it and take action. So your homework is, how can you draw attention through contrast to your call to action? It may be through the layout of the page, where that call to action is positioned. It may be through colors, it may be through style, through design. It may even be through copywriting. If someone is reading through your site, the call to action copywriting is compelling enough that it contrasts with its surroundings and pushes people to take action. All right, let's talk about number 11, rituals and norms. Now, I want you to think about the last time you had a conversation with somebody face-to-face. Now, when you're talking to somebody face-to-face, there's certain norms of communication that you're expecting, certain rituals to take place. The person is going to probably look you in the eye. Maybe they're going to nod their head. They may say, uh-huh, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Now imagine a conversation where that doesn't happen. The person just stares at you with a blank face. You're like, what's up with this person, right? Like, are you even listening to me? Do you hear it? Do you understand what I'm saying? Are we speaking the same language? Because the norms and the rituals of conversation have been violated, immediately you're on guard, something's amiss. Now our customers on our e-commerce sites are the same way. They're expecting certain rituals and norms when they come to do business with you. And when those are missing, it starts to undermine the trust that you have with them. For example, when someone comes to check out, they're expecting to give you certain information, your name, address, email address. And when you don't ask that stuff, people start to wonder, well, how am I even going to get my product? Or they also are expecting some reassurances. This is safe. It's secure. Don't worry. Everything's cool. If you want to return it later, that's fine. And so if people start to not see those reassurances, those rituals, those norms that they're used to, they start to doubt you. And they're going to go somewhere comfortable where they can see those. All right, so your homework assignment is to audit your checkout experience. What familiar norms, patterns, and rituals are missing from your checkout? You may audit it against your competition. You may audit it against the best practices you see out there. And so once you identify those, you can say, oh, maybe that's why I'm having a problem with my conversion rates in my checkout. Maybe people want to see this reassurance, or I should present the information in this manner. Okay, let's talk about number 12, which is framing. Now, we as e-commerce sites, we can frame or position or present information in a certain light that is more appealing to our customers, and something that they'd be more receptive to reading and to giving. So when you go to checkout on most sites, you may see something like this. So if you're a new customer, we ask you, hey, do you want to log in or do you want to create an account? And so in so doing, we frame for this new customer this experience and the experiences they've had before on other e-commerce sites. You want me to create an account again? Another one with another password that I have to confirm? I'm not going to remember this stuff later. And so immediately, instead of starting out with, hey, thank you so much, you're going to buy our stuff, it's like, oh, this is going to be a painful experience, right? This is dredging up the history of other sites, which may or may not have been pleasant in the eyes of your customer, because that's how you framed the information, the form that you're asking from customers. Now, if you contrast that with something like this, hey, are you a returning customer or are you a guest? Hey, I'm a guest. I feel great. Welcome. Come on in, guest. It's all cool. Now, this site may very well ask you the same exact information on the next screen as the other one, but it frames the presentation and the question in such a light that it's more appealing, more welcoming, more inviting to the customer. And it doesn't dredge up the negative connotations of other sites that they may have been on before. So your homework is to consider, how do you frame your checkout experience? How do you frame the information that you're asking from customers? Is it such that it's welcoming and inviting, or is it reminding people of some pain points they've had in the past with other e-commerce sites? Okay, let's talk about number 13, feedback loops. Now, we see these all the time in the real world, like when you're on the phone, you push the numbers, and you either hear the tone, or you feel the difference in the button, or you can see visually that something happened, so that you know the phone received the digit that you put into the phone. Now, likewise, on websites, customers are entering data all the time, and we need to communicate the fact that, yes, we got your data, we're working on it, and something is happening. Here's an example from Priceline. You enter your search, I want to find a hotel in Austin on these dates, and you say go. Like many sites, people enter information, and they say go. So immediately, Priceline gives you feedback. Something's happening. On this screen, you've got William Shatner. He's doing like a little dance with stuff. And so time starts to fly by because you're paying attention to that. The dots are moving across the screen. You know something is processing. But notice how in the middle, they reiterate the data that you entered on the first screen. So yes, OK, I know you're working on it. That's cool. And I also know that you got my dates right. I know you got my destination right. And before you know it, boom, here's the results. You find the hotels that you're looking for. So on our e-commerce sites, customers enter information all the time. And so you need to make sure that customers know something is happening. There may be a delay in processing their information. Put up these screens or spinners or other ways to communicate to customers that something is happening. You've got their information. You're working on it. Everything's going to be great. And boom, here's the result. All right, let's talk about fireworks. Who's seen a fireworks show? Hopefully everybody, right? 4th of July or New Year's. Now, when you think about the last fireworks show that you went to, you're sitting through the show, you know, the fireworks are going up, you think, ah, oh, this is all right. This is an okay fireworks show. But then you get to the finale. And the finale, they put up so many fireworks you can't count them, so many different colors you can't count them. The entire sky is full of lights, noises, colors. And you, at the end of the show, you think, that was pretty awesome. That was an awesome show. Even though moments ago you're thinking, this is kind of, I don't know. Now, this relies on the principle called the peak-end rule, where When we look back at experiences, we often remember some of the peaks, the highlights of the experience, and we remember the end of that experience. Now, we as e-commerce merchants, the end of our experience oftentimes is the thank you page. We confirm that we got your order. We need to make that a happy ending for customers. Too often the case in e-commerce is that there's this black hole between thanks for your order and here's when the product actually shows up on your doorstep. And customers start to have doubts in that black hole of what's going on. Where's my product? When am I going to get it? How do I even get started to use it? So we need to create and craft that happy ending on the end of our purchase experience. Here's an example from Domino's. Who's ordered a pizza from Domino's online and seen this, right? So there's no black hole of where's my pizza, right? They immediately start to show you, hey, your pizza's in the oven. It's cooking. Okay, your pizza's in the box. Okay, your pizza's in the car. It's coming to your house. Hey, knock, knock, it's on your door. So there's no ambiguity as far as what's going to happen to my pizza. And they have this happy ending. It's not done at the point of sale, I got your money, because you entered your credit card. It's done when the product gets to your doorstep. So how can you have this strong finish? How can you have this happy ending for your customers on your website and through your e-commerce channel? Don't just end, say, hey, thanks for your money. Have a nice day. How can you guide them to the next step so they feel reassured they made a good decision and they can get started with your product? Which leads us to our 15th tool in our toolkit, which is consumption. If people don't use your product and they don't use your service, they're not going to buy it again. And they're definitely not going to tell their friends about it. They're not going to tell their boss that they need to buy 100 more of these, right? And so we as e-commerce, we cannot say our work is done once the purchase has been made. We need to encourage consumption and use of that product or that service so that people come back next time and buy from us again. Here's an example from SEO Moz. Anybody used SEO Moz? Search engine optimization service. So you sign up for a free trial, and they use this principle of consumption. They know that if you don't use that free trial, you're never going to become a paying customer. You're never going to be back. So they send you these triggers, these emails. Say, hey, how's it going? Did you know that you can use this feature or that feature? Here, let's show you how you can do it. And so they encourage usage and consumption through these triggers to remind you that you have this service available, to pull you back and engage you such that you're actually going to use it. So your homework is, what would push your customers to actually use your product? How can you trigger that reminder and push them to take action with the product, use it, consume it, be happy with it so they buy it from you again? All right, we've talked a lot about some of the complexities of the choices we give to customers on our sites. We've talked about some tactics of how you can address those, how you can counter those. And you say, Gijo, you gave me these 15 tools, right? Didn't you share in the beginning this example of jam? And there was these 24 jars of jam, and I never knew which jar to get, so I just walked away. So here we have 15 principles of how you can improve your conversion rates. Which one should I even use first? Which one should I apply first? Well, the beauty of e-commerce and on the web is that you can measure everything. You can measure when customers come to your doorstep, and you can track them through your site to see where the problem and the pain points are for your customers. You can take that data and you can map it out over the flow of your site. You can say, well, as they progress through these pages, this percentage of people drop off. And you start to see where the pain points and the problems are for your customers. So once you identify those problems, you can focus on the biggest drop-off first. So where are the most people having trouble? Put some laser focus attention on that and see how you can address that problem. So once you identify where the problem is, it's time to figure out why. And that's where this tool called 5Whys comes into play. Who has used the 5Whys method? This is something borrowed from the good old days of lean manufacturing, where you ask the question why, literally 5 times, to get back to the root cause of the problem. So you don't get hung up on the symptoms or the downstream consequences of the original problem, but you can get back to the original problem and solve that problem. So you ask why 5 times. Well, nobody's taking my call to action on my page. Well, why aren't they taking my call to action? Well, the button's at the bottom of the page. Well, why is the call to action button at the bottom of the page? Well, our content management system has all this stuff at the top. It pushes it to the bottom. So you keep asking questions, and you get back to the root cause of something you can change, tweak, and adjust to improve that conversion rate. And then you get to be a scientist. You get to experiment. The beauty of the web is that you can experiment very easily through split testing and A/B testing. Throw up something new with one of these principles we've talked about, and compare it against your old version and see which one has a higher and a better conversion rate. Now, your homework, of course, is to apply the principles that we've talked about today. Otherwise, it's all for naught. Now, we talked about 15 of these tools. Which one you use is going to be up to you and your site and your product and definitely your customers. It could be the first one we talked about, simplifying and streamlining the choices that you give to customers so it's easy at a glance to make a decision. It could be helping them understand the cause and effect of these choices so they're not scared of the downstream consequences of that choice or that purchase. It may be organizing your offerings and eliminating distractions so people are only seeing what they care about, what they need at that time. It could be asking a series of attribute-based questions that ultimately builds up to more complex decision or complex purchase. It could be leveraging the power of defaults and recommendations so people don't have to make all these micro decisions. You can help jumpstart them on the way to making that selection and that purchase. Leveraging localized social proof, because when somebody they trust already trusts you, the prospective customer is more likely to trust you and take that step, that leap of faith. Remember ownership bias. If you can help customers customize, personalize your product, they're going to feel like it's theirs even before they buy. So naturally, they're going to take that step and purchase. Remember pricing anchors. You can position your price against your other product offerings to make your products look very attractive, or against your competition through showing maybe a list price or retail price and showing the discount. Remember scarcity. When things are scarce in either time or quantity, we want to take action right now. I need to buy that right now because otherwise, if I wait, it's going to be gone. So when you communicate that scarcity to customers, they're more likely to take action right now. Remember contrasting your calls to action so that it catches their eye. They know what they need to do on this page to move to the next step. Remember rituals and norms that customers are expecting when they come to your site. If you start to step outside those bounds and break those norms or those rituals, when things go wrong, they start to think, oh, that's why things are not working right. This is not what I expected. And they're going to back out. You can position the information that you present to customers and the information you ask of customers in a positive and encouraging light so they take action. Remember feedback loops so that they know the information they have entered has been received, that you're working on it, that you're processing it, and everything's going to be cool. Remember the happy ending. We're not done when we collect the credit card, but we want our customers to have an outstanding, happy ending and propel them to the getting started experience with our products and with our services, which of course is our consumption. We want them to actually use the product that we have, otherwise they're not going to buy or purchase from us again. All right, so I want you guys to go back home, put on your lab coats, your experiment, do some A/B tests, and see what is going to work by applying these principles of how we act, how we think, what our human behavior is on your sites. Now, ultimately, you need to do something with these principles. Too often, the temptation is to simply copy something visually that we see on another site. But if we understand why that is working, what's the principle behind that, then we can apply that principle in any other situation, any other project or website that we're working on. So if you apply these principles of psychology, you do your homework, you will increase your conversion rates, and of course, you'll make more money. And with that, I want to thank you guys for your time. Here's the slides if you want to grab them. Thank you guys for attending. If you have any questions, there's a mic up here. Mm-hmm. Can you go to the mic? Yeah, we're recording this for a podcast, so you can be famous. That's why.
Just so with so much structure to it, how do you allow for like happy accidents? Like maybe not in something so structured as what you're specifically selling, but to just let the customer discover, right?
Okay.
Just curious what your thoughts would be.
Well, one thing that comes to mind is a lot of these e-commerce sites will leverage the behavior of other customers or perhaps your browsing history to recommend similar, although not maybe in the same product family or the same product class, but something adjacent to that, an accessory or some kind of recommendation. So leveraging showing other products that you offer may help people go down and say, oh, that's also interesting. I'm intrigued. I'm going to go down that route as well. Yes.
Hi. I just had a question around pacing. So I work for a bank, and our products aren't really impulse buy. So yeah. Our customers come back several times before they actually make that final decision. And when we do interviews, they don't really want anything that feels rushed. Right. So can you maybe talk about a different kind of buyer?
Absolutely. So So at National Instruments, we have very similar buyers. We are a B2B company, and some of our products are very cheap, and they could be impulse purchases from an engineer, but some of them, you're going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it's a very drawn-out B2B cycle. And so a lot of the things we talked about, particularly in the beginning, about reducing the complexity of choices, where you're essentially online, you're creating a virtual salesperson, where this person, where your site interacts with the customers, help them understand the choices that they have before them, that then they can then take back to their decision maker, their manager, their committee, empowered, say, this is the best choice for our group or for our company, and here's why, because you've empowered them with all the options and the choices that they have before them. So some of these interactive experiences where you're asking the customer questions, and it becomes, if they can't purchase online, it also becomes a very good lead generator, where at the end of that experience, you can say, if you give us your email, you know, we can send you this information, and you can capture that, and it becomes a very highly qualified lead because they've already spent a lot of time interacting with you and learning and configuring, for example, your products. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Omar Nassif with Yomobi.com. I really enjoyed your talk. I love psychology. You mentioned two things, which is, one, limit choices so that people have an easier decision tree, but then you also said customize, give them the option to customize so they can take ownership of it. How do you frame the fact that you've limited their choices to help them get a better end product? How do you frame that in such a way that they don't feel like you're not allowing them to customize the product? You're not giving them something that is unique to them.
Okay. That's a great question, Omar. So if we're helping customers decide amongst our entire product line, all our product lines of products, so one way of eliminating that complexity is to make sure they first get to the right product, generally speaking, product family, that they can then go on to customize. So maybe it's like a reverse funnel. So you funnel them down to a particular product or family, they reach that certain product, and then maybe it opens up again where they have more options to configure that particular product or service.
You talked about simplifying the choices, but also not giving people too many choices. And so I think sometimes it can be hard to strike the right balance. Do you have any thoughts on how to marry those two?
So to balance the showing too many choices.
Right. Not limiting it like Freebirds does, you know, to where there's like 12 options, but they're all really simple versus, you know, giving them too many choices so they kind of go, ah, this is too many.
Yeah, that's where if you can leverage what you already know about the particular customer. So based on maybe they're coming into your website from a particular AdWords campaign or something, so you know maybe their demographic or their particular interests, you can pre-filter your products or offerings down to a smaller set of choices. Or even if you can determine from their IP address what company or what region they're from, to tailor the initial things that they see on the page or on the site. Yes?
Hi. When you do split tests, do you usually just stick to split tests, or do you also do multivariate tests?
We've just tried split tests to try to keep it as simple as possible.
Yeah. So
maybe it changes on a single page, where you're just changing one particular thing on a page, or maybe let's just revamp this entire experience and compare it against our old experience. I would recommend starting with a simple A-B test first and then work your way up to more complex things.
What software do you use for a split test?
We've been experimenting with Optimizely and Visual Website Optimizer. But those may or may not scale to a bigger enterprise need. So right now we're in our infancy of that type of testing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yep. Hey, Omar.
Hello. Hi. I had a follow-up question based on what you had said, which is to first funnel them into a specific product and then give them options. But more than once, people have said that, you know, the end product I'm getting looks exactly like somebody else. How do you psychologically make them feel happy with the fact that you've limited their choices? So I understand, you know, get them to a certain point, then give them options. But how do you make them happy with the fact that you limited their choices? Make them feel like there's a reason that you've done it and you're not doing it to be arbitrary. Like, make them happy with that end result.
Okay. I think that we have a very similar problem where we have to help people get and customize and configure these large systems. And so the tactic we take there is we want to make sure that you get a product that is actually going to meet your needs and is going to work for you in your situation. Now, we sell very technical products with that regard, where we don't want you to buy something that's not going to work with the other product that you're also purchasing. So we frame it in the light of, we're going to make sure, as you are customizing this product, that we make sure these products are going to fit and work together properly. So perhaps emphasizing the fact that as they customize it, it's going to be guaranteed to look just like you see it on the web. Perhaps they can see it visually, they interact with it on your site. So they're reassured that, yes, how I customize this is really what I want, and it's really what I'm going to get. When there's a disparity between what they see online and what they end up getting in the box, that's when they start to have reservations next time they come shopping. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for your time. If you have other questions, feel free to come up. Thank you.